Okay, Daniel's visions, his four visions, chapter 7, 8, also 9 and 10 to the end of the book, those four visions are like layers. They give us more information. He shares a little bit more with each one. We saw in chapter 7 how we're introduced to this character, the Antichrist, and he gives us more information as we go. So this perhaps is quite straightforward now. This is Daniel chapter 2. This is Nebuchadnezzar's vision, dream rather, the kingdoms predicted by the different metals. Chapter 7, Daniel's vision, different symbolism, but covering the same history. So in Daniel's vision, he has the different creatures or beasts to speak about the same thing. Now in Daniel, and at the bottom there, you can see the toes and the horns are both speaking about the ten kings. Now in Daniel chapter 8, in the vision of chapter 8, he only focuses in on two of the kingdoms, namely the Medo-Persian kingdom being subdued by the Greek kingdom. And this prophecy is an important one because he plucks out a particular character in history. I mean, then it was beforehand, it was prophesied. We look back now, it's history, but at Daniel's time, it was yet in the future. He plucks out a particular character who foreshadows the Antichrist in different ways. So if you look, there's different symbolism. You'll see that there is a ram with two horns. One is higher, came up than the other. It's speaking of the Persians who came afterwards, became more dominant than the Medo-Persians. And they were pushing west, north, south, and none could withstand them. And then we're told in chapter 8, in verse 8, the male goat grew very great. And when he became strong, the large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. See that? It spells it out. There it tells us clearly that the large horn refers to the first king of the Greek Empire, speaking about Alexander the Great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable horns came up towards the four winds of heaven. Again, we see that fulfilled by the four generals of Alexander who succeeded him. Incredible. And out of one of them, so you've got these four horns. We remember the different empires, right? The Ptolemaic, the Seleucid Empire, etc. Out of one of them came a little horn, which now we know to be a king being raised up. Is a little horn that becomes a powerful king, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and towards the beautiful land, speaking of Israel. Now, this little horn that came out of one of them is fulfilled in a historical king known as Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. That meaning God manifest. That's the meaning of his name. So he didn't have any self-image issues. But he was the eighth king of the Seleucid Empire. He is the one that came out of one of them, out of Seleucus, out of that. And he was in power from 175 to 164 BC until his death. This, by the way, is during the silent years between the Testaments. So when we speak about the silent years, we only mean that there was no new prophetic voice that was raised up, but God was certainly active, working, and setting the stage for the coming of Christ, of course. But during that time, this is when this king was raised up. And his characteristics and some of the things that he did foreshadow the future little horn, the Antichrist. It's not uncommon in prophecy that you have the record of the prophecy of something and it bleeds into another. It has one fulfillment, but it also has another fulfillment looking beyond it. We see that, for example, in David's, in the Psalms, where David is speaking about David, but there's another messianic element to it. It's speaking about King David, but it's also speaking about the ultimate son of David. Or Elijah, and John the Baptist, etc. It's not uncommon that there are prophecies with a secondary complete fulfillment. So this prophecy in Daniel's time was looking ahead to Antiochus Epiphanes, but also ultimately it was foreshadowing Christ. When Antiochus was in power, he imposed the Greek culture. He wanted to unify the people. He forced them to worship Zeus. The worship of Yahweh was forbidden at the pain of death. He halted the sacrifices. Now that should jump out at us, because several times that's echoed in Daniel about the Antichrist, that he would stop the sacrifices, which, by the way, tells us by the time the Antichrist comes onto the scene, the temple will be rebuilt, the sacrifices will be operating again, and he will perhaps even be influential in causing that to happen. But at the midpoint, he will halt the sacrifices. This is what Antiochus did. He also stopped the feasts. He burned the Torah. If you were caught with a copy of the law, you would be killed. Mothers who circumcised their sons were crucified. Jews that were keeping the Sabbath were burned to death. There was a vicious persecution of the Jews. The records say that tens of thousands were slain and killed and put into slavery. In 168 BC, he did something unthinkable. He dedicated the Jewish temple to Zeus, and he made sacrifices to an idol, perhaps in his own image, we're not sure, and a pig was offered on the altar in the temple. Now, there couldn't be anything more horrific or sacrilegious to the Jew than that would happen, that a pig would be offered by a Gentile in the temple. Unbelievable. This event in history is referred to as the abomination of desolation. It is a key event that triggers what we call the Great Tribulation in the end times. This event, the abomination of desolation, yet future, when the Antichrist will do this similar thing in the future, that will trigger the Great Tribulation. We see in Daniel 8:11, he even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary, God's sanctuary, was cast down. The Antichrist in the future will also act in the same way. He will exalt himself as high as the prince of the host. He will stop the daily sacrifices, etc. In Revelation 13, it tells us that the Antichrist, and let's not forget, this is a man, this is a human being in future history who will be of a certain nation. He will be a political figure. He will be come onto the world stage, etc. And he will make an image of himself and put it in the temple to be exalted as God. Again, so the temple is rebuilt, the sacrifices are put in place, and at the midpoint, he will bring an end to those, again, as an echo of what happened with this historical king. We read, again, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3, Paul, writing to the church there, says, "For that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." Back to Daniel 8 in verse 12. "Because of the transgression, an army or a host was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices." Again, that phrase, the transgression, we see it in the next verse also. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said, how long will the vision be concerning? And notice, the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation. This is when the temple was made desolate because of that, of what happened there. Now, when Jesus was asked by his disciples on the Mount of Olives, which you know, brought forth what we know as the Olivet Discourse, Jesus' own teaching on the end times, Matthew 24, really Daniel and Revelation, and that key chapter is are keys for us to study the end times. When Jesus was asked by his disciples about the end of the age, he referred them to this event. But he did it as though it was something that was going to happen in the future. So he referred to Daniel's prophecy, which then was past, which was looking to Antiochus, but he referred to it as a future event because the ultimate fulfillment is in the Antichrist. Let's look at that in Matthew 24, Jesus speaking, saying, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, and then Matthew takes time to put this in. This is Matthew's edition. Whoever reads, let him understand. In other words, go to the end time seminar, study the book of Daniel, study the book of Revelation, understand what the abomination of desolation is, understand who these prophecies are referring to, understand the timeline in some growing measure as a disciple, as you are learning. Whoever reads, let him understand. Verse 16, and then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. And why does it say that? Again, because the abomination of desolation, that image set up in the temple where the Antichrist reveals himself for who he really is, and he stops the sacrifices and opposes that expression of faith in Jerusalem, he will begin to persecute particularly of particular focus on the Jewish people. So let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Because in verse 21, oh, I don't know why that's there. Okay, let's have a look at this. Let's just have another quick look at that timeline. Again, that 7 years will start with a covenant that the Antichrist will make with Israel. And in the middle of the 7 years, he will set up his image in the temple. Oh, that's why, yeah, just to explain what I just said, to show what I just said, which will start the Great Tribulation. Now, in Daniel chapter 9, and don't worry, we're not going to fully go deep into, we've taught on that a few times in the church here. However, we certainly need to mention it because arguably, one of the most important end times prophecies is right here at the end of Daniel. It deserves our attention, certainly, but we're going to just quickly frame it now. And I want to apologize for that because it's such a wonderful prophecy to study. But nevertheless, there is a prophecy commonly known as Daniel's 70 weeks or the prophecy of Daniel's 70th week. And let's have a quick look at that. Together. Jeremiah the prophet, again, had prophesied that after 70 years were completed at Babylon, God would visit the people, he would return the captivity, they would turn back to the land, right? The context of Daniel 9, after Daniel, who was a young teenager, has been in captivity his whole life and is now an older man, he is now almost at the end of the 70 years. And he's studying the prophecies of Jeremiah, and he suddenly reads this prophecy in Daniel 25:11 and other prophecies where it clearly says you will be in captivity for 70 years. And Daniel says, wait a minute, we're almost at the end. And Daniel begins that wonderful, famous prayer where he begins to confess his own sins and the sins of the people. And, oh, we have transgressed. And, oh, please show your mercy to us. Remember your covenant, etc. Pleading with God that he would honor his covenant and turn the captivity. And it seems that Daniel perhaps had the idea that now the kingdom was going to begin. We're going to turn the captivity. We're going to return to the land, and the kingdom will begin. So Gabriel is sent from the presence of God to correct Daniel a little bit and show him exactly what was going to happen. And famously, we have what's known as the prophecy of Daniel's 70 weeks. And in this prophecy, in Daniel 9:24, it speaks of 70 weeks. The Hebrew word for weeks is actually sevens. So it's actually a time period of 7 times 70, which is 490 years. So Daniel lays out this timeline of 490 years and says that some incredible things will be fulfilled before the end of that, relating to the kingdom that would come. In the next verse, verse 25, he then focuses in on 69 of those weeks. Again, if you convert that, it's 483 years. This prophecy is astounding because he gives us a start to that timeline, and he tells us what will happen at the end of that timeline. He says, from the commandment to rebuild the city and the temple, which we know in Nehemiah 2:4, we know who gave that command, Artaxerxes, and we know when he did it, until the Messiah will be 483 years. Or if you convert that to the Jewish year of 360 days, and I didn't do all this, but it's been done for us by many great scholars before us, and you take out the leap years and all of it, you do all of the working out, you get 173,880 days. And if you count those days from the command to rebuild the temple and take it forwards, it lands on the day that Jesus rode into Jerusalem, presenting himself to be king. Incredible. If we could say to someone, do you know that there's a prophecy that was written 500 BC that told us the day that, not the year, the day that Jesus would be presented as the king, it would be mind-blowing. And there it is in our Bibles. So, but the prudent student here will say, okay, but wait a minute, there's a week missing. And of course, this is Daniel's 70th week. This is the important week. Where is that week? We should mention also, by the way, in verse 26, it tells us that after this, the Messiah will be cut off and not for himself. So not only does it predict the Messiah, not only does it tell us when he will come, not only does it tell us that he will die or be killed, but it will also not be for himself. Incredible fulfillment of prophecy. And then it says in that verse, and the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, which was fulfilled in AD 70 with Titus of Rome. So what about this last week, this final week, or this final period of 7 years? We've already framed it and set the stage for it. Remember, we looked at that earlier. But this is the all-important question when we look and consider the end times. That 70th week. It is yet future. The 69, we are now, so to speak, between the 69th week and between the 70th week. We are in this interruption in history. That interruption is called the church age. And we are waiting until the end of the church age when that last week will begin. So the Messiah was cut off, and then the church age, and then followed by that will be the... And this is laid out for us in 9:27 of Daniel, where we can read about that 1 week. Let's do that. First of all, that diagram there is just a quick sketch to show what we just explained. From the commandment to rebuild to Jerusalem to the Messiah will be 483 years. Then there is the church age after the Messiah was cut off and resurrected, etc. And the church age, so far 2,000 years, an undefined period perhaps. And then that will be followed by that final week, Daniel's 70th week. If we look back to that week starts with the covenant, has the midpoint, abomination of desolation, followed by the great tribulation. Now let's read the verse, which because of all of that, it should make some clear sense to us now. Let's read it. Then he, and this is looking back to the prince who would come, this is the Antichrist, then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. By the way, it's interesting that it says many. It indicates there was a majority that were for it, but there was a minority that wasn't. There's always a believing remnant, a discerning remnant at the time. Nevertheless, the covenant was made with many. The details of that, perhaps it would make sense that it's some type of peace treaty. Again, it could have an effect on how and why the temple was built, that there was an understanding that there were certain things that were negotiated. But nevertheless, this prominent world leader who rises to the world stage and is seen by many, the one who has the answers to the world's problems and world peace and the economy and peace in the Middle East and all of these things. And that's one of the things that this starts with. So the thing that triggers the 7 years is the signing of this covenant. And then the sand starts flowing, the clock starts ticking. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. In the middle of the week, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. And at the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. So that verse, which without any explanation, is quite something to work through, but it makes sense, doesn't it? Hopefully. So there again is that phrase, the abomination that causes desolation. That's the image or the idol in the temple causing desolation. And again, this is in the middle of that most documented time, the last 3.5 years. It goes on to say, and on the wing of the abominations, does it say it there? No, but it says, shall be one who makes desolate, even to the consummation which is determined. Oh yeah, it says it there, is poured out upon him. This is the point when we read in Matthew's gospel, when, remember 24:15, Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation that Daniel wrote of, the next verse says, let him flee to the mountains. It's believed that the place that the remnant of the Jews will flee to is Petra today, called Bozra in the Old Testament, a place that Revelation 12 says is prepared for them. We don't know that for sure, but there is a lot to There's a lot of strength in that argument that that's the place. So Zechariah 13:8 is an interesting prophecy. It shall come to pass in all the land, says the Lord. Two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein. This is a hard verse to fathom. But it's saying that two-thirds of the Jews that are alive at the beginning of this season will be killed. And one-third will be left therein. Look at the next verse. And I will bring the one-third through the fire, will refine them as silver is refined, and test them as gold is tested. They will call on my name, and I will answer them. I will say, this is my people. This is referring to what Paul says in Romans 11:26 as the point when all of Israel shall be saved. A verse that a lot of people stumble over. What does that mean, all Israel be saved? This is what it means. It's speaking about that remnant that represents all of Israel. At the end of the 7-year period, they shall be saved. They will go through the fire, through the time of Jacob's trouble, as it's called. They will be broken. They will look to the Messiah. It says there, they will call on my name, and I will answer them. And he will deliver them from the Antichrist and the forces and the ultimate victory at the end of Armageddon, at the end of the age there. Matthew 23, verse 38. See, your house is left to you desolate. And remember this scene, if you've been to Israel, when you come over Mount of Olives and you begin to descend the other side, and you're looking across the Kidron Valley, you're looking to the city of Jerusalem, and that's where Jesus stood. And he wept as he said, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, I would have gathered you, but you would not, you who stone the prophets, etc." And then he says, "See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more until," that lays down a condition, "you will not see me until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" This phrase from Psalm 118 is understood to be a messianic declaration. Oh, look at him. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. It's saying he is the Messiah. Right? And he's saying, you're not going to see me again. And he's speaking to the nation that has then rejected him as he's weeping over Jerusalem, knowing he's going in to face the cross, etc. He says, "You will see me no more until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" We shared recently in a sermon which had never come to me so clearly before, that it's very likely, in my opinion, that Isaiah 53 would be the text that would be written for the repentance of the nation at the end of the age. If you think about Isaiah 53, we often think of it as a future prophecy of Isaiah speaking about the cross, which of course it is. But you'll notice it's written in what tense is it written in? It's written as they are saying, "Oh, we did not esteem him. We," you know, it would be so fitting for the Jew and the Jewish nation to use that text and say, "Oh, look, we did not esteem him. We gave him over. He was," you know, so that's interesting. You can read that Isaiah 53 with that in mind, and it's quite something. But nevertheless, we know in certain words, the nation will come to say, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." Revelation chapter 12 in verse 6. Again, there's some symbolism here, but again, the symbolism is clear because it's explained. But it says, "The woman fled into the wilderness." Now, in the context there, if you look at the woman is the one who brought forth the promised child. The woman is speaking about the nation of Israel. The woman fled into the wilderness. When did she flee into the wilderness? In Matthew 24, 16. Flee. If you're in Judah, when you see the abomination, flee. And this is when she flees into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, that they should feed her 1,260 days, or 3.5 years. In verse 13 of Revelation 12, "Now when the dragon," and of course that's identified as Satan a little bit earlier, "when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time, a times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent." Again, that's that last 3.5 years. In Daniel, back in Daniel chapter 12, "And there shall be a time of trouble." In fact, it's also in Jeremiah 30, verse 7, where it speaks about this time as the time of Jacob's trouble. Daniel here says, "Time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time." And in verse 7 of that chapter, Daniel 12, it says, "It shall be for a time, a times, and half a time." There it is again. "And when the power of the holy people," or some translations say the will of the holy people, "has been completely shattered or broken, all these things shall be finished." In other words, one of the things that the seven-year period, and particularly the tribulation, great tribulation, which is the persecution of the Antichrist, one of the things that it accomplishes, what it's doing that, is that it brings the remnant of the Jewish nation to understanding and faith, that they will call out upon him. that their will shall be shattered and these things shall be finished and all Israel shall be saved. Here is a rough timeline to reflect on some of the things that we've taught. I'm just going to say it. We remember in 1948 what an important, profound fulfillment of prophecy, really, when the Jewish nation was established. Because, of course, to make a covenant, you'd have to be a nation. You'd have to be in the land, and you'd have to be... So that had to happen, and that happened in 1948. Again, we can see that through these prophecies that the temple will be rebuilt. I remember one of the last trips we had to Israel, there was a few of us, we were standing up in the Muslim quarter on this, there's this huge plateau, massive area behind the Dome of the Rock. And you're just thinking, wow, this is where the Antichrist may be involved in seeing this temple built on this site that where the abomination of desolation will happen. I remember us just getting chills being up there thinking about the end times like that. So the temple will be rebuilt, the sacrifices will be reinstated, and then the first seal will be broken, which we're going to go into tomorrow as we look at the book of Revelation. And with the breaking of that first seal is the first horse of the horsemen of the apocalypse, as we call them. You know, the first four seals release these four horsemen. The first horseman is really describing the rise of the Antichrist to power coming onto the world scene. As we read in Daniel 9:27, he will make a covenant with Israel for 7 years. Seal 2 and 3 and 4 are opened. War, peace, famine, death. Halfway through, he breaks the covenant. The man of sin will be revealed for who he really is. He brings an end to the sacrifices. He sets up the image with the help of the false prophet who is working for his power and promotion in his government. Sets up the image, the abomination of desolation, to be worshipped as God. This persecution breaks open against the saints. What we call the Great Tribulation has begun. The persecution of the Antichrist against the saints. After the Great Tribulation comes what's called the Wrath of the Lamb. It's not uncommon in a lot of end times teaching that people don't make a distinction between the Great Tribulation. Actually, they don't make a distinction between the 7 years and the Great Tribulation and the Wrath of the Lamb. They are distinct. Many people speak about the Day of the Lord and they think, oh, it means that's the 7 years, which is the Great Tribulation, which is the Wrath of the Lamb. But they are distinct. There are overlaps, but they are different. After the Great Tribulation, which is the persecution of the Antichrist against the saints, then the wrath of the Lamb is released, and that's expressed in what's called the trumpet, mainly the bowl judgments. We should mention, by the way, and this is where we refer to the rapture, everyone on this side of the room is going to be raptured. We know that, as Paul taught the Thessalonians, that the church is not appointed to wrath. And in the context there, he's speaking about these end days. We understand that the church will not be subject to the wrath of the Lamb. Now, by the way, let me just throw this out there. If we have different views on that, this, it's fine. I'm not saying I know for sure, thus saith the Lord. I'm not dogmatic about this. You can't be and you shouldn't be. It's well said that when we come to Bible teaching, particularly the end times, we should whisper where the Bible whispers and we should shout where the Bible shouts. Sadly, many teachers of the end times are shouting where their Bible's whispering. And we can't do that. We shouldn't do that. So it's okay. We have our position and we are students of the scriptures. But it's okay if you believe the rapture's here and I believe it's here. It doesn't matter. We're both going up. If we're born again, and that's the most important thing. So, you know, I know Christians that would almost not want to speak to you if you have a different view. You're thinking, it's crazy. It's okay to have a different view. So I'm just gently expressing mine, but there are other views that have good arguments as well. Well, you know, let's not go there right now. So, so where were we? So the persecution of the Antichrist, yeah, followed by the wrath of the Lamb. So what we do know is that the rapture, what's called the rapture of the church, the removal of the church, happens before the wrath of the Lamb. That we do know. Where you put it before the wrath is another question, but whether it's called what's called the pre-tribulation, which is the title is misleading and erroneous, again, because they're saying the tribulation is 7 years. So pre-tribulation, they mean at the beginning of the 7 years. But really, the tribulation doesn't start till the midpoint, so it's not the right name. But you could say there's the pre-wrath view, which says that the church is taken up before the wrath of the Lamb, which is a very good view. But anyway, what we would agree on, whatever camp you're in there, is that the church is taken out before the wrath of the Lamb, which does mean or imply, and again, this depends on what view you land on, there's the question on, will the church go through what is called the Great Tribulation? In other words, that last generation of the church, the believers in that last generation, in that last 7 years, will they go through what's called the Great Tribulation? Will they be here on the earth, unraptured, and witness these things, the temple rebuilt, the Antichrist come onto the world stage, the image put in the temple, and the persecution to be unleashed? Will they witness those things? It depends on where you think the rapture is. I personally, and again, my view is I believe that the church, I didn't used to believe this, by the way, for the majority of my Christian life, I believed that the church was taken up at the beginning of the 7 years. And in more recent years, I have a leaning towards what's called the pre-wrath view, which means the church goes through the tribulation, at least part of it, and is taken out before the wrath of the Lamb. There you have it. So, this is followed by, or expressed in, we should say, the wrath of the Lamb, expressed in what's called the trumpet and the bowl judgments to follow. The Lord then, of course, returns. And there's this incredible campaign where the Antichrist gathers his forces to come against the Lord's Christ. And of course, this ushers in the it's really, when we think about the second coming, we think of it as a moment, a pinpoint moment that Jesus returns. But the parousia, the word meaning the presence, the coming of Christ, it's really a series of events that includes the rapture, and it includes what's called the when we think of the return and the campaign of Jesus coming up for the great battle and the Armageddon, etc. It's not a pinpoint moment, but it involves several things. It's commonly believed, and I forget the verse, what is that verse? I forget this reference for a moment, but where it says that Jesus will come and he will stand on Mount Olives. Based on that verse, many believe that when Jesus returns, based on the ascension in Acts 1, that he ascended from Mount Olives and he will return as he left. So they think, oh, it means Mount Olives, and look at that verse. But, and again, we can all be students on this and work it out. But there are amazing prophecies in the Old Testament, in Isaiah, in different places, that refer to the Lord coming up from Bozrah, which is Petra, with garments, with his soaked garments of blood, coming up from a war campaign from Bozrah to Jerusalem, and then his feet will stand on Mount Olives. But it's very possible that that's not where he returns. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. You can work through the verses. They're incredible. But anyway, we'll see. Which, by the way, would make sense if the Jewish remnant has fled to Petra or Bozrah and they are under siege by the Antichrist. It would make sense that that's where he returns and he defeats the armies of the Antichrist and then goes up to Jerusalem. But fascinating. Then the remnant of Israel shall be saved. At the end of the 7 years, the Antichrist and the armies will be destroyed. And all aspects of Daniel 9, remember 24, there are six things in there that are to be completed at the end of the 70th week, will then finally be completed, and the king and the kingdom is here.